Good afternoon and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Dr. Maher Kalaji. I'll be the moderator for today's program. I'm a scientist. I was born in Jordan from a family that hailed from Syria in the early part of last century. I was educated in England, where I obtained my bachelor's degree and my doctorate in 1985, after which I worked as an academic until 2009 before moving here to the US. And it was during that particular period when I was an academic in the UK that I was very fortunate and privileged to have met quite a large number of students and academics from the Middle East and work with them and collaborate with them. And trust me when I say this, that you only realize the complexity of the Middle East, but also the beauty of the mosaic of the Middle East when you're outside the region. It's very difficult for people to travel, local people to travel within the region due to restrictions, wars, visas, name it, they have it over there. So it's only when you're outside, you begin to look at this fantastic mosaic of cultures, microcultures, different ethnicities, different religious groups, and they make a fantastic, fantastic mosaic if you actually put away all your prejudices and look at it differently. Look at the Middle East from a different point of view. And there's nowhere where this mosaic is more fantastic. Actually, the jewel in the crown of this mosaic is in the exquisite and intricate work of today's subject, which is Lebanon. But before I go to explain, before I introduce our distinguished speaker today, I would like on behalf of the Commonwealth Club to also welcome our listening and internet audiences and invite everyone to visit us online at www.commonwealthclub.org. Now it's my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Eddie Simonian. Eddie is a Syrian Christian. He was raised in Lebanon and continued his education here in the United States. He has a master's degree in international studies from the University of San Francisco, and he wrote his thesis on the sectarian conflict in Lebanon. He will discuss today, hopefully, the complicated ethnic and religious history of Lebanon, a country which has been plagued by wars, refugee crisis, even as we speak now, still we have a refugee crisis, since the inception of the country in 1920. So would you please join me in welcoming Eddie Simonian for this afternoon's presentation.
Hi, thank you all for coming. Firstly, I want to thank Celia and Maher. So let us just start. I'll directly go into what I have to say. We don't have a lot of time. Lebanon, as Maher was saying, has been plagued by sectarianism and ethnic crises for centuries, actually, before even what we know today as Lebanon. But what truly created Lebanon was the massacres of 1860, in which Christians were massacred by their Druze overlords in the Mount Lebanon area. And then European powers decided to create a protectorate for the Christians under Ottoman rule. And Mount Lebanon government was created in 1861. Later on, as the Ottoman Empire started to fall, the Sykes-Picot Agreement, which I'm sure everybody has heard of, gave France control over the areas of Lebanon and Syria. And in 1920, the Treaty of Sèvres also made sure that France has full control of the area. And during that time, we all say that it's Europeans who created borders in the Middle East, but it's also people within the countries who influenced these borders. The Maronites in Lebanon, mainly the Cardinal Maronite of the time, decided that he didn't just want Mount Lebanon, which is a mainly Maronite and Christian ethnic area. He wanted a larger Lebanon, a greater Lebanon. So they went and lobbied with the French, and the French agreed and decided to give them what we know today as Lebanon, and back then what was known as Greater Lebanon. But the only issue is that that area that they were given was populated mainly by Sunni and Shia Muslims. Now, what happened was the French gave the area to Lebanon and they gave full control and authoritarian control to the Maronite Christians in Lebanon. And ever since then, you could understand the ethnic and religious tensions that started. So during that time, the French decided to divide the powers in Lebanon. So the president would be Marinat Christian, the prime minister would be a Sunni Muslim, and the speaker would be a Shia Muslim. So in essence, what religion you're born in, this, you know, dictates what you could become in politics in the country. And they gave the Christians a 6-5 majority in parliament. Now, to go back, just to explain that there are tensions between Sunnis and Shias and Christians and Muslims, but just to give some very brief explanation of the difference between Sunnis and Shias, the whole problem arises of who the first caliph in Islam is. The Sunnis believe it's Abu Bakr, the father-in-law of the Prophet Muhammad, while the Shia believe it's Ali, his son-in-law. And that, you know, of course, there's a lot of issues that happen later on, but that's mainly the, you know, what started the divide between the Sunnis and Shias within Islam. And again, 1926, as I mentioned, the Lebanese constitution was created and divided Lebanon, divided politics. And it's not just politics, it's also every job within the government, every civil job has to have a quota. If there's as competent as you are, as great as you are, you cannot rise within the ranks unless, let's say, you know, they need a Christian here or they need a Muslim there. So that, of course, creates a lot of tension within the country. And during that time also, the Maronites controlled everything. They controlled the presidency and they controlled the army. And in 1943, the Lebanese overthrew the French. And in 1946, the French left Lebanon. And during that time, a national pact was arranged where they instituted these divisions of the president being Maronite, the prime minister being Sunni, and the speaker being Shia within the constitution. But one thing that I always talk about and is that there's also a divide between the Christians and Muslims. The Muslims think it's an Arab country. The Christians refuse to think that. So a compromise was reached where Lebanon has an Arab face. And that was the compromise within the constitution. So Lebanon just has an Arab face. It's not an Arab country. So that was a compromise that the Christians agreed to with the Muslims. And what's going on in the Middle East always affects Lebanon. You know, nothing could happen in Lebanon without the approval of foreign countries. And the revolution in Egypt in 1952 and the rise of Jamal Abdel Nasser influenced the leftists in Lebanon. And that started the downfall of Maronite hegemony in the country. And one of the most, one of the most important events that happened in 1958 was the Eisenhower Doctrine was used in Lebanon by the president of Lebanon at the time to try to thwart Muslim overthrow of his government by saying that they've been influenced by the communists of Egypt and by Jamal Abdel Nasser. And the United States did intervene and they did save the presidency of Kamil Shamoun. Again, you know, during that time, in the 1960s, the refugee crisis started to occur in Lebanon, and that's when the Palestinians started to enter Lebanon. And now we have around 500,000 Palestinian refugees in Lebanon for a population of just under 4 million. So that is a huge, huge number. And that's just Palestinians, not counting the current Syrian refugees in the country, which are, depending on who you, what estimates you read, between 1.2 to 2 million Syrian refugees in a country of 4 million people. That is a very, very drastic number. Again, one of the, during that time, during the 60s, we all know the Six-Day War between Israel and Egypt, and that, of course, in essence, just took away the zeal of Jamal Abdel Nasser, and he resigned, but he returned. But during that time also, the Cairo Agreement occurred, and this is very important in Lebanon because that agreement gave Palestinians full autonomy in Lebanon within their camps. So they were allowed to do what they want, get armed and attack Israel and start whatever they want from their camps. So the Lebanese military, which was very infamous at the time, it was made after the Deuxième Bureau of the French military, which, you know, if anybody knows about their acts in Algeria and other countries, they're very strict, to say the least. So, and it was controlled by Maronites, so that was a big issue. And during that time, you know, in Lebanon, that's when the war started to happen. That's when the tension started to occur. And as we know, in 1971, when the King Hussein kicked the Palestinians out of Jordan, the PLO, Palestinian Liberation Organization, a lot of them migrated into Lebanon. And that started the, I would say that would be the start of the civil war in Lebanon during 1972, during that time. Interesting fact, during that time, the Black September Organization, I'm sure anybody here who's watched Steven Spielberg's movie Munich about the 1972 Olympic massacre in Munich. It was, yeah, well, it was by one of the leaders of the Black September Organization. And, you know, it's this guy's kind of like out of a James Bond movie, a villain out of a James Bond movie. He's called the Red Prince. He was a multimillionaire. He lived a lavish lifestyle, you know, women, parties, everything, traveled the world. And he married Miss World in 1978, who was Miss Lebanon in 1972. She's Christian, he's Muslim. The way he was killed is actually very interesting. The Mossad sent a European agent over there to seduce him, and she was able to figure out all his path and everything he does. And they placed a 100-kilogram TNT-loaded car next to where he was passing by, and they took him out. Again, kind of like out of a movie, out of a James Bond movie. The war in Lebanon started because of a small incident, actually. There was a christening happening at a church in Ashrafieh. Ashrafieh is like the heart of the Christian area in Beirut. And this christening was being attended by the Falange. The Falange party, or the Kata'i party, or the right-wing Christian party in Lebanon, who were influenced by Franco of Spain. And what happened was four Palestinian PLO members were passing by, the christening was occurring, and the Kata'i did not want them to pass by the church. A gun battle occurs, and one of the Palestinians gets killed. They go, the PLO returns, they shoot, they kill four Kata'i members at the church. And what happens next is disputed, highly, highly disputed between both sides. But the Kata'i, they get armed, and they await a Palestinian bus that's passing by, and they ambush it and kill everybody inside. Palestinian claimed that it was packed with refugees and children, women and children. The Kata'i claim it was packed by members of Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine. And that starts, in essence, that starts the war. It's the bus massacre, as it's known in Lebanon, and that starts the war. And one thing about Lebanon, back in the day, not anymore, your religion was on your ID card. So what religion you were was on your identification. And the next incident is very important because, again, with the Kata'ib, and a fight happened, and the son of one of the heads of the Kata'ib gets killed. So he goes and starts putting checkpoints in Beirut, and they start killing people based on their religion, on their ID. So they start stopping. If you're Muslim, you were shot down directly in the moment. And the Muslims did the same thing. It was a retaliation. Also, the same thing was happened. Beirut is divided into West Beirut and East Beirut. East Beirut is for Christians. West Beirut was for Muslims. And during the war, you know, if you're a Christian, you wouldn't go into West Beirut. Or if you're Muslim, you wouldn't go into East Beirut. And during that time, actually, a lot of assassinations happened in Lebanon. You know, we had a U.S. ambassador got killed in Lebanon in 1976. The CIA chief of office got killed in the 1980s. The Marine barrack attacks that killed over 200 Marines, U.S. Marines in Beirut. So during the war, it was very vicious. Around 150,000 Lebanese lost their lives. And of course, during that time is when Israel invaded southern Lebanon in 1982 and proceeded to go into Beirut after the assassination of the president, the Maronite president of Lebanon in 1982. And the incident that occurred afterwards is one of the most infamous incidents of the Middle East and led to the resignation of Ariel Sharon as defense minister. And that was the Sabra and Shatila massacre. What happened was after the assassination of Bashir Ismail, the Christian president of Lebanon, Israel decided to go into Beirut at the behest of the Christians. They wanted Israel to come in and help them in the war. And they went in and they surrounded a camp. And they allowed the Lebanese forces and Kataib to enter that camp. And what happened next was the massacre of anywhere between 1,000 to 3,500 women and children in the camp at the hands of the Christian militia. And the militia was led by a man named Idih Bay'a. He's one of the most infamous warlords in Lebanon. He got assassinated in 2002. He was an avid scuba diver. He had three scuba diving tanks in his car. As his car was driving, there was a car bomb placed in one of the corners. And the explosion of the TNT and the scuba tanks decimated his car. That was in 2002. I still remember I was at school, and we still remember the sound of the explosion that occurred during that time. But yes, so his nickname was Eshka, and that's because he loved the Heckler & Koch machine gun, MP5, and he used to always carry it around, and that was his nickname. Eshka, we used to, everybody called him. But the issue is that this wasn't an isolated incident. Several years before, there was a massacre by the PLO in a Christian village, and in that village, his fiancée died. And many view this as his revenge for the death of his fiancée, in which he went in, he got, you know, the worst of the worst of the people he could find that were in the war, and they went and had the battle, and it was one of the worst massacres that occurred during the war. But again, you know, the war was filled with such incidents. In 1989, a Taif agreement was brought into fruition, and it was in Saudi Arabia, in the city of Taif. And what happened was that the Christians lost most of their power. The Maronites lost most of their power. The presidency was no longer as powerful. Prime minister became the most powerful position. And parliament was 50-50 between Christians and Muslims. The Maronites were not happy until now. You know, they still talk about the Taif agreement as one of the greatest losses of the 20th century for them. And during that time, Syria got control of Lebanon, the hegemony of Syria and Lebanon, of Hafez al-Assad, his father. And the Syrian military was in Lebanon, around 60,000 armed members in Lebanon. They controlled every aspect of Lebanon. You couldn't be president, you couldn't be minister, you couldn't even be head of a municipality without the approval of Syrian intelligence. So that caused a lot of tensions with the Christians and, of course, some Sunnis, which culminated in 2005 with the assassination of the prime minister, the former prime minister of Lebanon, Rafiq al-Hariri, who's Sunni Muslim. And that led to a sort of, you know, alliance between the Sunnis and Christians to kick the Syrians out of Lebanon. And they were able to kick the Syrians out of Lebanon that time. But, of course, Syria still has a lot of influence in Lebanon. The most powerful political party in Lebanon, Hezbollah, or the Party of God in English, has their own militia funded by Iran. And they could take over Lebanon within a day. That's how powerful they are. And they're fully backed by Syria and Iran. And they're currently fighting in Syria. And, I forgot to mention, in 2000, Israel fully pulled out of Lebanon. And actually, a lot of Christians view that as, you know, as Israel backstabbing them because they wanted Israel to remain in. They wanted Israel's help, you know, against the Muslim population in Lebanon. And what's currently happening in Syria, of course, affects Lebanon. And Bashar al-Assad, the current president, is nothing like his father. His father was tough, but his father knew how to deal with foreign policy. He knew how to deal with foreign countries. Bashar al-Assad ostracized Arab countries for Iran. His father knew how to play the game. He knew how to deal with everybody at the same time. And I remember I was watching an interview a while back when I was in Lebanon, and they were talking about his father. And a foreign diplomat once warned his father, Hafez al-Assad, that he's playing on the edge. And his response still reverberates with me. And his response was, yes, we play on the edge, but if we fall, it will be over the bodies of our enemies. And that was Hafez al-Assad as compared to Bashar. Bashar, I view him nothing more than a puppet in the game over there. And what happened in Syria in the early 2011 was, from purely Machiavellian standpoint, was dealt with very, very wrong. You know, if you want to do something bad, you do it quickly and you do it very efficiently. You don't do it over a long period of time when, you know, the boys, the young kids that were taken by security forces and tortured over several weeks, etc. You want to put something down, you do it quickly. And that's what his father did in Hama in the 1980s, in which it was also one of the worst massacres in Syria. Tens of thousands of people got killed because they tried to overthrow his regime. But talking about Lebanon right now is in a big crisis because of the sectarianism, because of people putting their sect over the country as a whole. There hasn't been a president since 2004. There hasn't been an election since 2010. Parliament renewed their term until 2006 by themselves. And there's a huge shortage of civil servants within the government. There's 1.5 to 2 million Syrian refugees, 500,000 Palestinian refugees. And there's a very bad trend of the presidents being former military leaders. So since they can't agree on anybody to take the presidency, they just put the last general, every person who was the army commander, as president. And this actually connects to the broader issue in the Middle East and what's happening in Iraq and Syria. Lebanon was based on sectarianism. Iraq is currently based on sectarianism. And we see the problems going in Iraq. And I think Iraq, what's happening in Iraq was foretold by what happened in Lebanon. And the same would be about Syria. If Syria is going to be made into a country where, you know, the presidency would be Alawite and the prime minister would be Sunni, etc., you're making sure that people are more loyal towards their sect and to the country as a whole, and that causes tensions, and that creates a dichotomy within society and it divides society. And that's a very dangerous thing that's happening in the Middle East, all over the Middle East. And, you know, I think I went over my time, so I'm just going to open it up to Maher, and thank you.
Thanks to Adi Simonian for his comments about Lebanon. Now it's time for the question and answer period, and we have a number of questions, very, very diverse. I couldn't group them into different one or two or three groups. They're all different questions, which is quite interesting. I'd just like to remind you, my name is Maher Kalaji. I'm the moderator for today's questions and answer period. And I'm going to use my privilege as a moderator just to ask the first question. I promise you just the first one. Eddie, I mentioned in the introduction that Lebanon is an exquisite mosaic. You know, to create a country is one thing, but to create a nation is another. And I told the truth, but not the whole truth, because this mosaic is cracking. It's cracking all over. It's actually symptomatic of the whole Middle East. The whole society there is cracking. Now, my question is, these cracks which are appearing, are they due to something which is new, or are they due to the artificial borders that have been created? Is it time to start redrawing the borders in the Middle East? I know it's a nasty question, but is it time to start looking at different divisions in the Middle East, if any? What's your take on that?
Now, I think this issue has been going on for centuries. I think the ethnic tensions over there have been going on for hundreds of years. Yes, the borders created by European powers weren't actually the smartest thing, and they inflamed the issues over there. But the main problem is the tribal loyalties and the sectarian loyalties within the Middle East, within whether Syria, Iraq, Saudi Arabia, etc. You know, when you have, you know, people putting their tribes or their sects first, you're not going to be able to create a nation. You're going to be creating several nations within a nation, and that is never good. That never creates something that will last. You know, the most ideal scenario would be have a small country for, you know, a country for the Kurds, a country for the Alawites, a country for, you know, Sunnis, etc., something like that. But I think that's unrealistic in the current scenario in the Middle East. Unfortunately, I see more violence, more tension. I see people trying, you know, it's within our nature to try to control, to try to have hegemony over others. And I just don't see Iraq or the Shias or Sunnis in Iraq saying, oh yeah, let's give away the Kurdish region for a Kurdish state, or the same in Syria. They're going to want to have the whole country, and they're going to want to have hegemony. You know, as Voltaire used to say, a slave first wants to be free, but then wants to be master himself. And that's what, you know, we're seeing over there with the revolutions. And you know, I have a very negative view of these revolutions. There's a French saying, la révolution dévore ses enfants. And the revolution is devouring its children in this situation. And I'm just very pessimistic in that aspect.
Okay, thank you. I have a comment here from the audience. And can you hear me at the back? Yeah. And it's to do with a comment that you made at the beginning about the Arab face of Lebanon. And you mentioned that the Christians do not want to be associated with that, whereas the Muslims do. I also want to add to this is that, if I'm not mistaken, most of the pan-Arab nationalist movements which started in the Middle East emanated in Lebanon with the Greek Orthodox Christians, not the Muslims there. They were actually the ones who were carrying the flag. So can you sort of jumble these two together in terms of the Arab face and the Greek Orthodox Christians?
Yeah, of course. So during that time, you know, of course, the ones who were in power were the Maronite Christians, and they don't view themselves as Arabs. They view themselves as Phoenicians. So if, you know, you ask any Maronite what he is, he's not going to say Arab, you know, I'm Phoenician. And they vehemently do not want to be viewed as Arabs. On the other hand, Orthodox Christians in the Middle East, as Maher said, yes, they were at the forefront of Arab nationalism. The founder of the SSNP, the Syrian Socialist National Party, is a Christian. The founder of the PFLP, Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, George Habash, Orthodox Christian. So yes, the Orthodox, they do have an Arab nationalist view. But if you're talking about, you know, the powers that be in Lebanon, the Christians that are in control in Lebanon, which are the Maronites, they don't view themselves as Arabs. They view themselves as descendants of the Phoenicians.
Thank you for that. On probably the same note, I probably would like to point out here that the first president of Lebanon was not a Maronite. He was a Greek Orthodox Christian. And the first speaker of the parliament was a Sunni Muslim and not a Shia Muslim. So things have, you know, a habit of changing in Lebanon. It's a short history, so maybe things will change in the future again. I have a couple of questions vis-a-vis the USA. The first one is, what can the average American do to help facilitate peace in the Middle East?
Yeah, that's, you know, honestly, you know, foreign intervention and all that could only do so little. At the end of the day, it's about the people over there. And when you have such diverse areas and diverse countries, you know, democracy shouldn't be on the top of your list. You look at what's going on in the Middle East, and a lot of people have a choice. Do you want, you know, democracy and chaos, or safety for your family and being able to survive and live and have a, you know, somewhat good future? And I know people who were in Iraq, Christians who were in Iraq during Saddam Hussein's time, and they wish that they could go back to that time. You know, yes, they couldn't, you know, they didn't have the same everything. They had rights, they had everything. I know a member of the Republican Guard, he was forced to resign as a captain in the army. Yes, he wasn't able to go up in the ranks as much as he would like to, but he still said he had everything he needed. He was able to have a successful business and everything. Now, look at Iraq, look at what's going on, look at the sectarian tension. So, you know, sometimes you need strong people in charge. You need the iron men or iron ladies in charge. you know, as for foreign, what could the average American do? Foreign intervention. I just truly think that this is these issues have to be solved within those countries.
Thank you. We can't escape clearly the issue of the war in Syria and the refugee crisis, which is affecting the whole of the Middle East. And while I'm on that note, actually, I should have said this right at the beginning. We are delighted to know today that Eddie, who works for a company here in the Bay Area, I'm sure I can name the company, Levi's, he was partly instrumental in working with the company and convincing them to donate $100,000 towards the refugee crisis. So thank you for that, Eddie. Well done.
Thank you.
On the issue of the problems at the moment, I have two questions. What is happening to the Christians in the areas which have ISIS presence in Lebanon?
Okay, so Lebanon doesn't per se have ISIS presence as we would think in Syria, where ISIS controls vast swaths of land. There isn't that. There's an area called Darsal, which is in North Lebanon, but it's a Sunni area that has an organization called Al-Nusra, which is allied with Al-Qaeda. And they're up there. They kidnapped 30-something soldiers. Until now, the Lebanese government is still trying to bargain the release of these soldiers. And they're trying to use Qatar and Turkey and other countries to try to mediate. But as Christians in Lebanon, I will say this. As safety-wise, Lebanon, Jordan, these countries for Christians are as safe as can be, because the same threat that is would face Christians would face Sunnis or Shias in Lebanon. So there is an issue with the safety against ISIS. Now, of course, the main thing would be car bombs and lone wolf attacks, and that is the most dangerous thing, happening over there, assassinations. But that happens in all areas, not just Christian areas. I know there were several mosques that were attacked, so it's happening in every area in Lebanon.
Thank you. There's a question here, or a comment, or a question regarding the number of refugees in Lebanon, about 1.2 million Syrians, 500,000 Palestinians. The population is about 2 to 4 million Lebanese, or 6, I can't remember, 4 million Lebanese. If you look at that, nearly half of the residents in Lebanon are refugees. How does the country cope with feeding, housing, taking care of these refugees, if it does?
Yeah, the country as a whole, the government does very little. It tries to have aid coming from Saudi Arabia, from Qatar, etc., for the camps. I was there, I just came back in January, actually. I was there for 6 months. And it is a very, very disheartening situation. And you see the refugees on the streets. You see a mother, with 3 children whose husband died in Syria on the streets. You have women. And as always, in all these situations, the biggest victims are children and women. And what's happening is a lot of families that go to Lebanon, they're thinking, hey, we can't feed our children. We try to marry them off. So a lot of young girls are being married off. And that's very unfortunate, because a lot of them are being taken advantage of, put in prostitution, etc., stuff like that. And there is a very racist culture in Lebanon. The Syrians aren't viewed in a very good light. They're not viewed. They're the butt of our jokes over there. We have the Humsa jokes. I don't know if you've heard of them, Maher. But so it's very tough over there. And there's a lot of Lebanese trying to do something. But as a whole, what I noticed when I was there, a lot of people just became, used to it, as if nothing's happening. They see people on the street, they just became used to it. It's as if nothing's going on. They continue with their life. And it's not that they could help and they don't want to, but you're talking about a country where the average salary for someone starting work after 4 years of college is $800 a month, and you're talking about people my age over there not being able to find jobs and et cetera. So just compounding everything on top of each other. And the government, the main fear right now is that we have to look back at religion also. All these refugees, the majority of them are Sunni. You know, so that's why the parties in Lebanon also are very, very worried about that. They're worried that, you know, if they remain in Lebanon, what kind of, what will happen to the balance in Lebanon? What will happen to the sectarian balance in the country? So a lot of people are very unwelcoming. They want them to return at any cost. You know, you have people that just want them to leave the country at any cost. You know, talking about, you know, no air zone, no fly zones on the border, etc. But yeah, it's a very dire situation.
I have a comment here which relates to the last few statements you made regarding the maintenance of the balance of power in Lebanon, where the Maronites have more opportunities for example, higher education, etc. I'm not sure if this is correct. Is this a reason why they're assuming the majority of political position based on competency? And does that threaten peace in Lebanon, you think, that they have more opportunities than anybody else to progress within the system?
They used to. The Maronites used to have, before the Ta'if Agreement of 1989, they had the presidency was nearly absolute. The president could fire the prime minister, the Sunni prime minister, anytime he wanted. The Speaker of the House, who was Shia, has very little power. Right now, it's not the same, but I will say this. The Maronites do have a disproportional representation based on their numbers in Lebanon. Very disproportional. They make up, if you're looking at the current statistics, which, by the way, it's a very taboo subject in Lebanon to talk about population data and see like how much each religion is by percentage. It's a very taboo subject, but if you're looking at foreign, like, you know, you go to CIA.gov and check the population, Christians in Lebanon probably make anywhere from 35 to 40%. Maronites make 20% out of that. Yet, based on that, they have such a disproportionate access, you know, to, you know, civil jobs and everything. So yes, that in that aspect, yes, I would say, you know, based on their population, they do have more access to you know, positions within the government.
Thank you. This moment, I'd like to remind our listening audiences that this is a Commonwealth Club program called Lebanon. I'm Dr. Maher Kalaj, your moderator for today, and our speaker is Eddie Simonian, an Assyrian Christian who was raised in Lebanon and continued his education at the University of San Francisco here in California. I would like to go back in history a bit and ask you about the role that France initially played in Lebanon, which has clearly identified, influenced its present-day politics. Actually, the first flag of Lebanon was the French tricolor with a cedar in the white strip in the center. They mainly supported the Maronites, and they supported them until the 50s of the last centuries, 50s and 60s. Does France still have a role to play in Lebanon? I know that they arming the Lebanese army at the moment with a $3 billion grant from the Saudis. Some unholy alliances in Lebanon. So can you comment, please, about the French and the role there?
Yeah, you know, the Christians in Lebanon call France our sensitive mother. So it's the protector of the Christians in Lebanon and in the Middle East. There's still a huge alliance, I would say, with France. You know, like whenever something happens, you see the leadership of Lebanon going to France and trying to curry favor from the, whether it's Hollande or Laurent Fabius, et cetera. And Lebanon as a country is a francophonic country, and we still, you know, everybody over there speaks English, Arabic, and French, and French is still actually one of the legal languages. But Christians, yes, they do view France as their protector still until now. You know, you see, when a person wants to be president, for example, a Christian has to be president, wants to be president, a Maronite, one of his first trips is to France. One of his first trips is to go and meet with the French president and, you know, tell the French president why he should be the president of Lebanon. And whenever there's issues surrounding Lebanon, you know, you always see France, France, France on the news. Everything is France trying to solve the situation. Yes, of course, it doesn't have the same influence that it did when, you know, during the early 20th century, but Yes, the Christians still view it as their protector, as the sensitive mother. France is the sensitive mother of Lebanon.
Thank you. I have a question here, which I'm sure many Lebanese will disagree with, but I think it's absolutely factual, about strong leaders being often a problem. And the citizens of Lebanon, they actually identify with the sect they belong to. We all know that sects are not genetically identifiable. So the DNA is not different from a Maronite to a Greek Orthodox to a Sunni to a Shiite. When you were growing up in Lebanon, has anybody actually questioned this notion of being identified with a sect and saying we're all, I don't know, Lebanese, Beirutis, or from Mountain, so and so, not Christians or Muslims or Druze or Shiites, etc.?
You know, I was very sheltered, and the area I was in was a Christian area. I was telling Maher, I lived probably like 10 miles away from a refugee camp, never, you know, heard about it, never knew about anything like that, never knew about what was going on. So it's I went to a private Catholic school, and, you know, so it wasn't embedded in me that, hey, we're all, you know, regardless of your religion, everything, you know, you're all the same, and etc. So it's all about religion, you know, since a young age. It's, you know, I'm a Christian Lebanese, I'm a Muslim Lebanese, I'm this, I'm that. You know, of course you have the communist parties in Lebanon, etc., and leftist parties, you know, put Lebanese first. But I'll say the story. When my parents were first trying to put me in school in Lebanon, finding a school, there were two prominent private schools in Lebanon. One was called ACS, and it's an American school, but it wasn't a religious school, and my mom did not want to put me there. So it was one of those liberal leftist schools, and she did not want to put me there. So she put me in I went to Catholic school. So it's just a different, I grew up in a different, you know, different group of people then.
Thank you. I have a couple of questions here about Hezbollah, and a related question about the U.S.-Iran deal. I need to elaborate a bit more about the influence of Hezbollah in Lebanon, but also the U.S.-Iran deal. With the money, will Iran be sending more money to Hezbollah as a result of this deal because they have less to worry about?
Firstly, pertaining to Hezbollah within Lebanon, in 2007 or 8, there was an issue that occurred. Hezbollah was having their own telecommunications network within the country, and the government wanted to stop that. And what occurred was that within 48 hours, Hezbollah took over all Beirut and all its suburbs. They didn't enter any Christian areas, but they took over all Sunni areas in Beirut and the suburbs. And that forced the government to resign and forced a meeting in Qatar to resolve the issue. So just that just shows you how powerful they are. Within 2 days, they took over the capital of Lebanon. They're the most trained and highly advanced group in Lebanon. They're more powerful than the military. One thing, though, yes, they could they could win any battle in Lebanon, but they can't control the country number-wise. They don't have the numbers. The military has 100,000 people. You could have, you know, all over Lebanon. Hezbollah, 6,000 to 10,000 fighters, depending on who you ask. And they have, of course, like 20,000 reserves. But their real numbers are, you know, 6,000 to 10,000. So, yes, they're very powerful and highly, highly funded by Iran. They have an arsenal of 100,000 rockets in the south. And, you know, every day if you hear Hassan Nasrallah's speech, who's the head of Hezbollah, you know, he threatens every day, rockets, rockets, rockets. And just to say this, yes, they threaten Israel, but they also have the same tone of speech with other Lebanese. So they have the same tone of speech with Lebanese. Anybody who doesn't agree with them is automatically an Israeli agent. So you have that over there. As for funding from Iran, I have no doubt. I have no doubt that Iran will increase their funding. And firstly, you have to understand they're fighting in Syria. So I'm certain they're going to be sent more weapons, etc., to fortify their position in Syria.
Thank you for that. We all know about the different sects in Lebanon in terms of Sunni, Muslim, Shiites, Orthodox, etc. Are there any Jews left in Lebanon? And if they are they treated equally as everybody else? Are they full Lebanese citizens? Do they have any problems there?
Actually, I was looking at the census a few years back when I was looking at the elections, and they see, you know, so it shows each religion how many people they have. I remember the under Jews, they had seven people. This is an interesting fact, though, that Hezbollah actually funded the rebuilding of a synagogue in Beirut. And they wanted to portray themselves as not anti-Semitic, but anti-Israel. And that was a few years back, and they were fixing it up. There are Jews in Lebanon. One of my uncle's friends, actually, he was born in Lebanon, but he migrated a long time ago. So I was reading an article about that, actually. Some businessmen in Lebanon, they are Jewish. They actually claim to be Christian. Just, you know, there's still that fear. There's still that fear that, you know, if someone, you know, like he's Jewish and he's a powerful businessman, that, you know, you have the, the anti-Semitism and everything. Oh, they control the country, et cetera, et cetera. So there's still that fear. But it's a very small number, very, very small number.
Thank you. As I mentioned earlier, there are some really unholy alliances in Lebanon. And one of them is between the Christians and the Hezbollah, as we know that. But also they have a habit of naming their political movements after days of the month. So there's a comment here from the audience about what's the difference between March 14th and March 8th? Not 6 days.
So what happened was in 2005, after the assassination of the Lebanese prime minister, in March 8, he was assassinated February 14 during Valentine's Day. And March 8 was when pro-Syria groups went and had a huge rally. And it was like, you know, they claim it was like 500,000 people or whatever, but it was mainly Shiites and their allies and some Sunnis in Lebanon. And all these people, all these political groups became known as March 8. They're the ones who went out to support the presence of Syria and Lebanon. 6 days later, there was a counter-protest. And it was all Christians, actually. They were united back then. Sunnis and Druze and a few other small parties. And that's the March 14 Alliance, which is anti-Syria Alliance. So right now in the news, whenever you hear like March 14 or March 8, March 14 denotes people who are pro-Syria. March 8 denotes people who are pro-Syria. March 14, pro-West.
Thank you. In the 50s and 60s and 70s, until the war in Lebanon, it used to be the financial center of the Middle East, but now that's moved to Dubai. So there's a question here: is what's the major income in Lebanon now, apart from olives and wine and tourism? And who finances all the wars and the divisions there?
You know, actually, banking is still strong in Lebanon, believe it or not, because of the privacy over there. And the United States has been cracking down on it because of money laundering concerns. So they've actually, 3 years ago, they shut down a whole bank. They forced the bank, the Lebanese Canadian Bank was forced to shut down, and it was bought by another bank because of money laundering concerns. Privacy over there when it comes to banking system and stuff is very, very strong. So you could open a bank account with very few problems. So that's still a big source over there. Of course, tourism is the main thing. Tourism is the main source. And it's, you know, people coming. But actually, a lot of Lebanese work overseas. They work in the Gulf regions. They work in the United States. And they send money back to their families. And that's the huge income. That's like, last time I checked, $5 billion in remittance every year. For a country like that, that is huge. And that's a big source of income for the people over there. And what was the last question? Funding. Oh, that's simple. It comes from, other Arab countries, Iran, you know, and you have, of course, other countries that want to send weapons and stuff. So, you know, the United States did send weapons, depending on the time and depending on the war. So, but of course, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, you have Turkey helps out, Iran, of course. So it's those countries.
Thank you. I think the modern history of Lebanon from the initial appearance of Islam in Arabia from 700, 600 and something, 700s until now, Lebanon has been under complete control of different Islamic empires, Islamic entities, with the exception of the 200 years when the Crusades were there. So I have a question here about when did the first Christian settlement of Lebanon occur? And is it still there? Do you know anything about that historically?
You know, I know we're talking about this. The Shahab family, like in that area, since the 1100s, they were there, but they converted later on. I know as Maronites, it goes back to 1400s or something like that in that region. And because Mount Lebanon is mountainous and stuff, and they could be protected from their surrounding areas. So if my memory is correct, I think the Maronites, when they went to Mount Lebanon, is like 1400s or 1500s, something like that, for Maronites. I don't know other sects.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know who asked the questions, but I do believe that the Maronites were initially the inhabitants of the valley, the Orontes Valley, the river which runs northern in Syria, and then they moved further into Mount Lebanon. I think the whole history of the Christian appearance in Lebanon cannot be separated from that in Syria, if I'm not mistaken. And it's all to do with the Nicene Creed and who agreed with it and who didn't agree with it, and the Fourth Congress afterwards, when you had the Melkites and you had the Assyrians and you had the Copts in Egypt. So there were big separations of movements.
Nestorians.
So I think they did appear way before that in Lebanon.
Mm-hmm.
There's a question here about, which I'm not sure if you'll be able to answer that, is how involved was T.E. Lawrence, Captain Lawrence of Her Majesty's Army, in the creation of Lebanon after World War One?
See, I can't answer that, but I know one thing is he actually warned the Middle East and the people over there that as long as their loyalties remain to their tribes and as long as people are more concerned about their tribes than whichever country they're in, there's going to be more tension and there's going to lead to, you know, divides and everything within the Middle East, which is true. But as for his influence, I don't know if he actually had influence in Lebanon. I know the creation of Greater Lebanon was actually due to the French, due to the Maronites going and telling the French, we want a larger region. We don't just want Mount Lebanon. We want a larger region.
I mean, I personally believe that the British have a dark history in the Middle East. And I think the interesting thing is that there were three entities in the Middle East. The Middle East problem itself, like Jordan, Syria, Lebanon, and Egypt, were run from the British office in Cairo, whereas the relationships with what became Saudi Arabia were run from India. And the issue of Palestine and the Israel was run from the Foreign Office in London. So I'm not sure that the left hand knew what the right hand was doing in terms of British politics in the Middle East. And this continues until today, I think. We have quite a personal question here to you, which is, how many languages do you speak and what are they?
Well, I speak three, but I understand also Aramaic. I'm not fluent.
We're not going to test you on these anyway.
Yeah, I'm not fluent in Aramaic. So I don't count it as a fourth, but I do understand it. When I was a kid, I used to speak it, but then when I started going to school in Lebanon, we had to learn English, Arabic, and French. And not Aramaic, and maybe that's a regret. I wish I knew it, but so it's Arabic, English, and French.
Unfortunately, we have time just for one last question, and I'm going to take the liberty of asking you this question. And again, it's a personal one. You've been away from Lebanon for quite a while now. What is it that you love about the country, and what is it that you hate most about the country?
You know, whenever I go back, there's something that, you know, as much as I don't want to admit it, but there's something that just takes me back whenever I go back. Maybe it's the culture, the people. Because when the group of people I'm with, when we're out and everything, when we go out and you see each other, you don't know who's Muslim, who's Christian. You know, like one of my very close friends who's a Maronite Christian was dating a Sunni Muslim. And you can't tell. You know, you go out, you have fun. So there is that aspect of it. There is that aspect. But unfortunately, it has more to do with the social status within the country. You know, like the poorer you are, the more you're entrenched with, you know, like your religion and you want to, that's what you have. So there's that aspect of it. I love the culture. It's very open. People are very, you know, respectful of you. And it's just different. It's you go there, the food is amazing, the nightlife and all that. What I really hate about the country is, you know, I was talking to Meher about this. One of the things that really bothers me is the plight of domestic workers in Lebanon. You know, like you see every week someone commits suicide and it just bothers me so much that this happens. And it's one of the things that I just, when I'm in Lebanon, I really hate it. I hate that about society, that they treat people, you know, there's still people who view themselves as above others. And I remember once this was a big issue in Lebanon at a swimming pool. They had pricing for people to go in. It was, you know, males, females, children, and then miscellaneous. And by miscellaneous, they meant foreign workers, you know, like the maids and everything in the country. And that bothers me. And of course, as a whole, as a country, we still have a lot to move forward, whether it's in women's rights and, you know, female rights in general. And, you know, you can't, you know, divorce is controlled by the church and all that stuff. And it's just a lot of issues. You know, I could go on and on about what I hate, but I'll just stop there.
Thank you very much for sharing these personal thoughts. It's time now to thank Eddie Simonian for his presentation today. We also thank our audiences here, especially you, for asking all these fantastic questions and making these comments. And those listening to the recording and on the internet, I'm Dr. Maha Kalaji, moderator for today's program about Lebanon. Now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating over 110 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.